This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last week, Chinese-American human rights activist Harry Wu was arrested in China and charged with espionage. Wu spent 19 years, from 1960 to 79, in Chinese prison labor camps for such crimes as being an intellectual and a bourgeois. He's lived in the U.S. since 1985 and became a citizen last year. The determination he once used to keep himself alive in prison, he has since used to try to expose human rights violations within Chinese prisons. At great risk, he's returned to China several times to document prison abuses. On one of his trips, he snuck into prison labor camps and used a hidden camera to film a report for the news program 60 Minutes. Wu has often testified on Capitol Hill about Chinese human rights abuses. Both houses of Congress have passed resolutions condemning China for his imprisonment. In a few minutes, we'll talk with China expert Orville Schell about how this is affecting Chinese-American relations, which were already at perhaps the lowest point since normalization in 1979. First, we're going to hear an interview I recorded with Harry Wu in January of 1994, after the publication of his memoir, Bitter Wind. He told me that in order to survive in prison, he turned himself into a beast.
If you're thinking you are human beings, then you are thinking about freedom, family, future, sex, right and wrong, and those things only cause suffering. And a hungry beast only thinking about grabbing food from anywhere, it's easy to survive.
One of the ways you found to get a little bit of extra food was to look for rat holes, because where there was a rat hole, the rat might have stashed some grain, some corn. What was the best stash you ever found in a rat hole?
I still remember my very lucky times. I found a rat horse. The rat is a very good collector. They collect same size, the soybean, they collect the rice, collect the corn, and in their hole, even you pull the water, you cannot damage the storage. If one day one of the prisoners can find a rat horse, then he become like a millionaire, you know. It's really good. And if we can cut the rats, and also we eat it.
And the rats too. So you ate rats?
I ate a lot. And also the frogs, mm-hmm. snakes, mm-hmm. any kind of life.
When you would find food, would you try to share it with other people?
No, never.
Or was it's too important to survive?
No, never, yeah. Never. I never share with the other people. And always try to grab the people from other people. I did it many times. I beat in them and robbed their food. If I'm strong, I did.
A couple of years ago, in 1991, you decided to go back to China to try to document the prison camp system there. And you took a hidden camera with you. You did this for 60 minutes, so they helped, I guess, equip you with mm-hmm. what you needed to take pictures and to take video. Mm-hmm. Why did you take the risk to go back to China and do that?
First of all, the pieces of land in the Asia we call China, that is my motherland. My parents, my brother, they're still over there. And many of my inmates, my friends, they're over there. I cannot stop thinking about them. The nightmares always come back to me. I'm lucky. I survive. I want to enjoy my life in a peaceful land. I'm a very normal person. I want to be loved. I want to love. But I cannot turn back on these people. These nameless, voiceless, faceless people. Forget means betray. I cannot do that.
Harry Wu recorded last year. Harry Wu was now imprisoned in China on charges of espionage. My guest Orville Schell is the author of several books about contemporary China, including Discos and Democracy, To Get Rich is Glorious, and his latest, Mandate of Heaven. Shell is a senior fellow at the Freedom Forum at Columbia University and serves as vice chair of Human Rights Watch Asia. Orville Shell knows Harry Wu. Earlier today, I asked Shell if he comprehended why Wu risked his life to document human rights violations in Chinese prisons.
Well, it's been a question that I've asked myself many times, and indeed asked him as well, because he is such a singular person. Not only that he's willing to take risks, but that he has such a dogged determination. Obligation he feels to bear witness to the dark side of the Chinese Revolution, which he experienced for 19 years. And this is, I think, very unique in China, where, you know, particularly of late, people's tendency, if possible, is to forget and to sort of be very ahistorical, to try to begin again as if the edifice of society and reform and the economic miracle didn't really need to sit on any historical foundation, or if the country, the society as a whole, didn't really need to come to terms with the magnitude of the brutality and the self-inflicted brutality that so many people suffered over the past 35, 40 years.
What specific conditions has Harry Wu been trying to expose in Chinese prisons?
Well, he, as you know, spent 19 years in a series of reform through labor camps, and he was put into them for reasons which are still obscure to him. I mean, it really was a Chinese version of Kafka's trial, that try as you may, you can't ascertain why you're there. And when he asked, he was simply be told, you know why you're there. You know, the perfect way to summon up all sorts of guilt in someone without ever actually telling them what their crime is. And I think that this experience was so brutal that during the worst of it in the early 60s, when a mass famine swept China and 20 to 30 million people died and conditions in the prisons were just abominable, and one of his friends died in his arms and he saw many other people die in their sleep beside him, he simply decided that if he ever got out, he would bear witness, that this would be his, you know, almost sacred obligation.
Now, I know he did a report for the BBC on how the body organs of executed prisoners were being used for medical transplants to wealthy Chinese people. And this was also the subject of a report by Human Rights Watch Asia, which was issued last summer. What are the specific ethical and human rights violations that are being charged here?
Well, most Chinese find it unacceptable upon death to surrender organs for transplantation. This is just a cultural bias. So this means that there's a real deficit of things such as kidneys, corneas, livers, pancreases, organs of that nature. Now, from a very practical point of view, many Chinese see nothing wrong with extracting these organs from prisoners who are executed, thinking that in a certain kind of a realistic way, this helps them pay their debt to society. And here we run into a whole series of cultural biases that, you know, prisoners don't have rights, neither do dead people in China. It's very different from the kind of cast we put on these sorts of things here in the West. So this has meant that as the medical science made transplantation more and more popular and is a rather common route of curing people with terminally diseased organs, that the temptation to take them out of prisoners, indeed sometimes to take them from prisoners before they were fully dead, to schedule executions to coincide with actual operations and to have the public security bureaus and hospitals link up, was very great. And there's numerous instances of documentation which really show, I think, beyond a reasonable shadow of doubt that this is a very widespread phenomena. And some people think, you know, upwards to 90% of all transplanted organs come from executed prisoners.
Now, Harry Wu's BBC report has been challenged on this basis. The footage that he showed, that he said was footage of a transplant of an executed prisoner's kidney, was actually footage of a routine heart operation. What do you know about that?
Well, I think it was a bit of at least quasi-sloppy journalism on the part of the BBC to show a chest instance of chest surgery when they were talking about the transplantation of other organs. But I think what happened was they were at a certain hospital where Harry Wu was inquiring about getting a kidney, and they allowed them to see this operation. And so they, I think, somewhat foolishly put it on the screen, and it's very obvious what it is. It isn't a kidney operation. But having said that, one doesn't want to defend it. But I think it doesn't in any way cancel the rest of the BBC's report, and indeed many other reports that have also in great detail documented this practice as being commonplace.
Both houses of Congress passed resolutions condemning China for Harry Wu's arrest and urging President Clinton to use every diplomatic means to win Wu's release. Do you think that Harry Wu is, that his arrest is kind of playing into different political agendas in Congress?
Well, I mean, I think Congress, in a certain sense, is rightfully incensed. But in another sense, I mean, it's an all-win situation for them. They don't really have to do much except pass resolutions. So they don't have to work out the praxis of how you get Harry Wu out and how you work out a really workable foreign policy. But I think, you know, it's about time for the president to do what President Bush did. I didn't really agree with everything he said, but he went to Yale and he gave a real China policy speech. And I think this is long overdue. I think it would clear the air. And I think if we were to arch our backs a little bit at the same time that we try to find common ground with China on certain other grounds, it would be a very sort of salutary thing and might help choke up this terrible knot that we both have swallowed, both of our countries.
Let's look at why this is such a low point in Chinese-American relations. President Clinton recently allowed the president of Taiwan to come to the United States. Why was that so upsetting to China?
Well, you know, I think presently in China, the government, the party, the whole edifice of its political structure feels tremendously weak. You know, Deng Xiaoping is basically non compos mentis. There's going to be a very...
He's what, almost 90?
He's going to be 91 next month. And everybody knows that there's liable to be trouble after that. So I think they're feeling very vulnerable at home. And whenever the Chinese politicians and the party feels weak at home, they tend to project and they tend to try to export issues so the people will pay attention to relations, what's going on abroad or between them and Taiwan. And so Taiwan is a perfect issue for them to sort of rant, rave, and rail about when they feel they've got to express some toughness. They've got to show some spine. And I think that's pretty much what we see. But we also have to be mindful of the fact that this is a very sensitive issue. You know, the integrity of the motherland, it's what makes Tibet such a bedeviling issue and makes autonomy sort of so unthinkable. But Taiwan, too, they imagine as theirs. So any insinuation that it's not gives them ample opportunity to sort of puff up and act out on an international on the international scene.
What are some of the other reasons that relations between the U.S. and China have deteriorated?
Well, Terry, you know, I think that one of the things we're seeing is a kind of an inchoate sense that many people feel, many Americans feel, and Europeans, that there's something wrong in China. They know about the economic miracle, and it really is very impressive, and you know, kudos should be given to China in a certain way, but there is this kind of sense that there's something mutant about what's happening. It's too fast, it's too unplanned, it's too rapacious, it's unfair, it's exploitative, all of these things. And so when something like Harry Wu comes along and a big incident develops, I think it has a way of crystallizing all this sort of inchoate bad feeling and allows people to use it as a kind of an outlet. It's a thing, something to gang up on, and I think we see this in Congress, a tremendous frustration amongst, you know, liberals and conservatives alike that China has not been held to account. Now you have to ask yourself, should we hold it to account? That's another question. Does the United States have the right to pass judgment on other countries and other systems and to interfere? Traditionally, we've always done that. We view it as a kind of our manifest destiny, whether it's missionaries or the World War II or the Cold War, Korea, Vietnam. I mean, we do project ourselves. But the Chinese see this as a real insult, and they don't like it.
My guest is Orville Schell. His latest book about China is called Mandate of Heaven. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with China expert Orville Schell. Our relations with China are unusual in the sense that, you know, the Cold War is over, yet China is still a communist country, but it's a communist country with this economic miracle, and we have a lot of business investments there and want to have even more. How much of the Cold War do you think is still in our relationship with China, still affecting our relationship with China?
Well, I think for people like Jesse Helms, you know, old anti-communists, it's very much present. And I think we have to kind of redefine it. We can't sort of mine these old Cold War sentiments. On the other hand, we can't just sort of surrender. And I think particularly to the mythology that, you know, open markets and business are going to create democracy. That's very fallacious. They may help and in the long run may have a very profound effect. In the short run, it may need more to open China up. And it's, I think that particular sort of myth is one that really does deserve to be analyzed very closely. But it serves, you see, as a surrogate for any other kinds of action. People who feel, oh, yes, we should do something, but on the other hand, we don't want to disturb business. Well, we'll just say that open markets equal open societies. But it's an incomplete analysis of what's going on, because I think it's possible, and we do see it, that to get what some have referred to as, you know, gulag capitalism or Leninist capitalism, where you have a political apparatus of the old Leninist mold riding herd on a Wild West, you know, market economy that's booming in ways that what we hardly could have imagined 5-6 years ago.
Well, as relations between the U.S. and China continue to deteriorate, China is planning to host the UN International Women's Conference in September. How is that progressing?
Well, it's progressing. You know, they've tried to sort of export it out of Beijing to get it away from the city because they're very fearful of what might happen when you get 35,000 outsiders running around a society which is politically closed. One of the things that I fear is that if the Harry Wu situation is not resolved, I could well imagine that you'd have people lined up in Tiananmen Square to, you know, drop banners saying "Free Harry Wu," which would be a terrible humiliation for China and would force them to act in ways which would just compound the problem and I think would give the Women's Conference a real black eye. So, I mean, this is no joke what's happened, and they've dug the hole a little deeper after they detained him and then accused him of espionage. It makes it a little harder to get out of. But I think until we find some solution to this problem, the Women's Conference is sort of the next stop on the train for trouble.
It's conceivable that Harry Wu could spend the rest of his life in a Chinese prison. Do you find yourself thinking what it would be like for him to spend the rest of his life back in a Chinese prison camp after having already survived 19 years there?
Well, you know, almost any other human being on Earth, I would be very worried about. Harry Wu is really tough. He has steeled himself to this. And the great paradox of his arrest is that he is carrying out his own work, the solitary individual, in a way which is infinitely more effective by doing nothing in this kind of Zen, you know, Taoist, Wu Wei, non-action manner, by sitting wherever he is in China, than he ever was able to do by being running around full speed outside of China. So for his purposes, and I think he knows this, to be there is to be successful. And I think the Chinese will realize this too and will want to put an end to it.
Did you ever find yourself saying to him, Harry, don't go, you're going to get arrested. I mean, why bring this on yourself?
I've said this to him every time, and there is an element about him which, I mean, there is a bit of zealotry in Harry Wu. There are very few people who would take his risks, but he, you know, has consecrated himself to this task, and it is a sacred task, and there is nothing on earth which is going to make him relent.
There's a second political prisoner who has been in the news. This is Chen Ziming, who was a leader of the Tiananmen Square protest in 1989. He spent 5 years in prison. He was released in May of 1994 for medical treatment. Then on the sixth anniversary of the crackdown, he signed a pro-democracy petition, conducted a day-long fast, and then ended up back in prison. Do you know him?
I've not met him. Of course, I know of his case. But I think, you know, what it's very tempting to imagine when you think of Chen Zeming or Harry Wu or Wei Jingsheng, who was in prison for 15 years, got out, and then a year ago was disappeared for another year and is still gone. It's very easy to imagine that the Chinese government is this sort of monolithic organization that's just taking these people away. But I think what's closer to the truth is that there's enormous debate within the hierarchy and enormous disagreement. Because after all, the people, for instance, in the foreign ministry who have to deal with the outside world, know that when they take someone off like this and lock them up, it has profound international repercussions, and they have to deal with those. On the other hand, there's people who are in China, maybe they haven't been abroad much, and they don't really care what the United States or any other country does. They just say, lock these bums up. You know, they're counter-revolutionaries. But I think that if we could eavesdrop on the Central Committee, we would find that not only was there great disagreement, but certain arms of the government just act and leave other arms to kind of deal with it, and that there's probably an awful lot of bad blood over these cases.
Do you know anything about the conditions that Harry Wu is being held under now and what the prison is like where he's being held?
Well, what we know from the consular visit that finally did take place, the U.S. consul, is that he is not being tortured, he's not being abused, and I suspect he's being treated very well. He may be, you know, they have many prisons, as we have here, which are rather luxurious by standards of ordinary prisoners. And I think he will receive quite careful, meticulous, if not royal treatment. And I don't worry that he will be physically abused, and I think it is almost unthinkable that he would be executed. One never knows, but this is my hunch. Harry Wu is too high visibility. He's too well connected in Congress and with the media and around the world for the Chinese to give him any more reasons than they already have to sound his horn when he gets out.
Orville Schell, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, as ever, Terry, it's a great pleasure.
Orville Schell's latest book about China is called Mandate of Heaven. He's a senior fellow at the Freedom Forum at Columbia University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.